The wipes work nearly as well on tree blood as it did on human. We drove on, searching for lights. We had to be close to Bloody Bones, unless the directions were way off. Here's hoping they weren't.
"Is that a torch?" Larry asked.
I stared into the darkness. There was a flicker of fire, too high off the ground to be a campfire. Two torches on long poles illuminated a wide gravel turnaround to the left of the road. The trees had been pushed back here too, but years ago. It was an old, established clearing. The trees formed a backdrop for a one-story building. A wooden sign hung from the eaves. It was hard to read by torchlight, but it might have read, Bloody Bones. Dark wooden shingles covered the roof and climbed down the walls so that the entire building looked like a natural growth that had sprung from the red clay soil. About 20 cars and trucks were parked haphazardly on the dark gravel. The sign swung in the wind, the torchlight reflecting off the deeply carved words. Bloody Bones was carved in smooth, curving letters. I walked carefully over the gravel in my high heels. Larry's dress shoes worked better on gravel than mine did.
Bloody Bones is a strange name for a bar and grill.
Maybe they serve ribs, I said. He made a face at me.
I could not face barbecue anything right now.
It wouldn't be my first choice either. The door swung inward directly into the bar. The door swung shut, and we were plunged into a fire-shot twilight. Most bars are gloomy places to drink and hide, a place of refuge from the noisy, shiny world outside. But as refuges went, this was a good one. There was a bar along one side of the room, and a dozen small tables scattered on the dark, polished wood floor. There was a small stage to the left, and a jukebox near the back wall, where a small hallway probably led to bathrooms and the kitchen beyond. Every surface was dark wood and polished till it shone. Candles with chimney glass over them shone from the walls. A chandelier with more chimney glass and candles hung from the low, dark wood ceiling. The wood was the darkest of mirrors, glowing in the light rather than reflecting it. The beams that supported the ceiling were carved with fruiting vines and stray leaves that looked like oaks. Every face was turned towards us like a bad Western. A lot of the faces were male. The eyes slid over me, saw Larry, and most went back to their drinks. A few stayed hopeful, but I ignored them. It was too early in the night for anybody to be drunk enough to give me grief. Besides, we were armed. The women were grouped three deep at the bar. They were dressed for a Friday night, if you plan to spend Friday night on a street corner propositioning strangers. They stared at Larry like they wondered if he'd be good to eat. Me, they seemed to hate on sight. If I knew any of them, I'd have said they were jealous, but I'm not the kind of woman to elicit jealousy on sight. Not tall enough, not blonde enough, not Nordic enough, not exotic enough. I'm pretty, but I'm not beautiful. The women looked at me like they saw something I didn't. It made me glance behind me to see if someone had come in behind us, even though I knew no one had.
"What's going on?" Larry whispered.
That was another thing. It was quiet. I'd never been in a bar on a Friday night that you could whisper in and be heard.
"I don't know," I said softly.
The women at the bar parted like someone had asked, giving us a clear view of the bar. There was a man behind the bar. I thought, what beautiful hair she had when I first saw him. The hair fell to his waist like thick, chestnut-colored water. The candle flames gleamed in his hair the same way they shone in the polished wood of the bar. He raised startling blue-green eyes, like deep seawater, to us. He was dark and lovely rather than handsome, androgynous as a cat. He was exotic as hell, and I suddenly understood why the bar was three deep in women. He sat an amber-filled glass down on a tiny napkin and said,
"You're up, Earl."
His voice was surprisingly low, like he'd sing deep bass. A man got up from the tables, Earl, probably. He was a large, lumbering man, formed of soft squares like a gentler version of Boris Karloff's monster, not a cover boy. He reached for his drink, and his arm brushed the back of one of the women. The woman turned, angry. I expected her to tell him to go to hell, but the bartender touched her arm. She was suddenly very still, as if listening to voices I couldn't hear. The air wavered. I was suddenly very aware that Earl smelled of soap and water. His hair was still damp from the shower. I could lick the water from his skin, feel those big hands on my body. I shook my head and stepped back into Larry. He caught my arm. What's wrong? I stared at him, clutching his arm, my fingers digging through the cloth of his suit until I could feel his arm solid under my hand. I turned back to the bar. Earl and the woman had gone to sit at a table. She was kissing the palm of his calloused hand.
Jesus, I said. What's wrong, Anita?
Larry asked. I took a deep breath and stood away from him.
I'm okay. It was just unexpected.
What was...
magic?
I stepped up to the bar. Those amazing eyes stared back at me, but there was no power to them. It wasn't like dealing with a vampire. I could gaze into those beautiful eyes forever, and they would still just be eyes. Sort of. I placed my hands on the gleaming wood of the bar. More vines and leaves curved around the edge of the heavy wood. I ran my fingers over the deep-set carvings. Hand-carved, all of it. His fingertips caressed the wood like it was skin. It was a proprietal touch, the way some men touch their girlfriends when they're into ownership. I was betting that he'd carved every inch of it. A brunette in a dress two sizes smaller than it should have been touched his arm.
Magnus, you don't need a stranger.
Magnus Bouvier turned to the brunette. He trailed those caressing fingertips down her arm. She shivered. He raised her hand gently from his arm, pressing his lips to the back of her hand.
Pick anyone you want, darling. You are too beautiful to be denied tonight.
She wasn't beautiful. Her eyes were small and muddy brown, her chin too sharp, nose too large for a thin face. I was staring right at her from not a foot away, and her face smoothed. Her eyes were suddenly large and sparkling, her thin lips full and moist. It was like seeing her through one of those soft filters they used during the 60s, except more so. I glanced at Larry. He looked like he'd been hit by a truck. A slim, lovely truck. I stared out over the bar, and every other male in the place except Earl was staring at the woman in exactly the same way, as if she'd just appeared before them like Cinderella transformed by her fairy godmother. Not a bad analogy. I turned back to Magnus Bouvier. He was not staring at the woman. He was staring at me. I leaned into the bar, meeting his gaze. He smiled slightly. I said, "Love charms are illegal." The smile widened.
You're much too pretty to be the police.
He reached out to touch my arm.
Touch me, and I'll have you arrested for using undue preternatural influence.
It's a misdemeanor, he said.
Not if you're not human, it isn't, I said.
He blinked at me. I didn't know him well enough to be sure, but I think I surprised him. Like I should have believed he was human. Yeah, right.
Let's talk at a table, he said.
Fine with me.
Dory, can you take over for a few minutes?
A woman came behind the bar. She had the same thick chestnut hair, but it was tied back from her face in a severe ponytail, high and tight on her head. The long, shining tail of hair swung as she moved, like it was alive. Her face, free of hair and makeup, was triangular, exotic, cat-like. Her eyes were the same startling seawater green as Magnus's. The men nearest the bar watched her out of the corners of their eyes, as if afraid to look directly at her. Larry stared at her open-mouthed.
"I'll watch the bar, but that's all," she said.
She turned those eyes to Larry and said, "What are you staring at?" Her voice was harsh, thick with scorn. Larry blinked, closed his mouth, and stuttered.
Nothing.
She glared at him like she knew he was lying. I got an inkling why the men weren't staring at her.
Dorcas, be nice to the customers.
She glared at Magnus. He smiled, but he backed down. Magnus stepped out from behind the bar. He was wearing a soft blue dress shirt untucked over jeans so faded they were almost white. The shirt hit him at nearly mid-thigh. He'd had to roll the sleeves over his forearms. Black and silver cowboy boots completed the outfit. Everything but the boots looked borrowed. He should have looked sloppy. Too casual among everyone else duded up for a Friday night, but he didn't. His utter confidence made the outfit seem perfect. A woman at one of the tables grabbed the hem of his shirt as he moved past. He pulled it out of her hands with a playful smile. Magnus led us to a table near the empty stage. He stood, letting me choose my seat, very gentlemanly of him.
I sat with my back to the wall so I could see both doors and the room. It was sort of cowboyish, but magic rode the air. Illegal magic. Larry sat to my right. He'd watched me and scooted his chair a little back from the table so he could see the room, too. It was almost frightening how seriously Larry watched what I did. It would keep him alive, but it was like being followed around by a 3-year-old with a carry permit. Kind of intimidating. Magnus smiled at us both indulgently like we were doing something cute or amusing. I wasn't in the mood to be amusing. "Love charms are illegal," I said.
"You said that already," Magnus said.
He flashed me a smile that I think was meant to be charming and harmless. It wasn't. There wasn't anything he could do to make himself less than exotic. He sure as hell wasn't harmless. I stared at him until the smile wilted around the edges, and he swallowed. He spread his long-fingered hands on the tabletop, staring at them. When he looked up, the smile was gone. He looked solemn, a little nervous even. Good.
"It's not a charm," he said.
"The hell it isn't," I said.
"It isn't.
A spell, but nothing as mundane as a charm." "You're splitting hairs," I said. Larry was staring at us intently. "Was that stuff at the bar a love charm?"
"What stuff at the bar?"
Magnus's face was incredibly mild, as if he thought Larry would believe him. Larry looked at me.
"Is he kidding? The woman went from a 3 to a 23. It had to be magic."
Magnus turned his attention to Larry for the first time, excluding me. And I felt excluded. It was like a ray of sunshine had moved away from me, and I was just a little colder, a little more in the dark. I shook my head. "Cut the glamour crap." Magnus turned back to me, and for a minute I felt that warmth.
"Stop it."
"What?" I stood up.
"Fine, let's see how funny you think you are in jail."
Magnus encircled my wrist with his hand. His skin should have been work roughened, but it wasn't. His skin was unnaturally soft, like living velvet. Of course, that could have been illusionary too. I tried to pull my hand away, but his grip tightened. I kept pulling, and he kept tightening with that certainty of someone who knew that I couldn't get away. He was wrong. It wasn't just a matter of strength. It was a matter of leverage. I turned my wrist towards his fingers in a quick turning motion, jerking at the same time. His fingers slid over my skin, trying to dig in, but it was over. My wrist felt rubbed raw where his finger had scraped along the skin. It wasn't bleeding, but it hurt anyway. It would have felt better if I rubbed it, but I wouldn't give him the satisfaction. I was, after all, a tough-as-nails vampire slayer. Besides, it would have ruined some of the effect, and I liked the surprise on Magnus's face.
"Most women don't pull away once I've touched them."
"You use magic on me one more time, and I'll feed you to the cops."
He stared up at me, a thoughtful look on his face. He nodded.
"You win. No more magic on you or your friend."
"Or anyone else," I said. I sat back down carefully, putting a little more distance between me and him. I angled the chair just a little to one side so the grab for my gun would be smoother. I didn't think I'd have to shoot him, but my wrist was aching where he'd squeezed. I had arm wrestled with vampires and shapeshifters. I knew preternatural strength when I felt it. He had it. He could have squeezed until my bones popped out of my skin, but he hadn't squeezed fast enough. He hadn't really wanted to hurt me. His mistake.
"Oh, my customers wouldn't like the magic going away," he said.
"You can't manipulate them like this. It is illegal, and I will turn you in for it."
"But everyone knows that Friday night is lover's night at Bloody Bones," Magnus said.
"What's lover's night?" Larry asked.
Magnus smiled, already regaining some of his easy charm, but that flicker of warmth was gone. He was being true to his word, as far as I could tell. Even vampires couldn't work mind control on me without my knowing it. That Magnus could made me nervous.
"I make everyone beautiful or handsome or sexy tonight. For a few hours, you can be the lover of your own dreams and someone else's. Though I wouldn't spend the night. The glamour doesn't last that long."
"What are you?"
Larry asked.
"What looks like Homo sapiens can breed with Homo sapiens, but isn't Homo sapiens?" I asked.
Larry's eyes widened.
"Homo Arcanus. He's a fairy?"
"Please keep your voice down," Magnus said.
He glanced around at the near tables. No one was paying much attention to us. They were too busy gazing into each other's magically enhanced eyes.
"You can't be passing for human," I said.
The Bouviers have told the future and made love charms for centuries around here.
You said it wasn't a love charm, I said.
They think it is, but you know what it is.
Glamour, I said.
What's glamour?
Larry asked.
It's fairy magic. It's what allows them to cloud our minds, make things seem better or worse than they are.
Magnus nodded, smiling, as if pleased that I knew so much.
Exactly. It's really a minor magic compared to some.
I shook my head.
I've read about glamour, and it doesn't work this well unless you're High Court, Dina Shi. The Seely Court of Fairyland doesn't interbreed with mortals often, at least not commoners. The Unseely Court, on the other hand, does.
He stared at me with his beautiful eyes, looking, even without glamour, so gorgeous you wanted to touch him. Wanted to see if his hair was as luxuriant as it looked. He was like a really fine sculpture. You wanted to run your hands over it and feel the lines.
Magnus smiled gently.
The Unseely Court is evil, cruel. What I do here is not evil. For one night, these people can come here and be their own fantasies. They think it's love charms, and I let them. We all keep the secret of this small illegal act. The local police know. They even come down once in a while and join in.
But it's not love charms.
No, it's natural talent on my part. Using my own homegrown magic isn't illegal if everyone knows I'm doing it.
So you pretend it's love charms and everyone looks the other way because they're having a good time, but it's really fairy glamour, which isn't illegal with permission of the participants.
Exactly, he said.
Which makes it all legal.
He nodded.
Now if I was descended from the dark side of fairy, would I do anything to bring pleasure to so many?
If it suited your needs, yeah.
Isn't there a ban on Unseely Court moving to this country?
Larry asked.
Yeah, I said.
Not if my family moved here before the ban went into effect. The Bouviers have been here for nearly 300 years.
Not possible, I said. Nobody but the Indians have been here that long.
Lynn Bouvier was a French fur trapper. He was the first European to set foot on this land. He married into the local tribe, Christianized them.
Bully for him.
So how come you didn't want to sell to Raymond Sterling?
He blinked at me. It would disappoint me greatly to find out you are working for him.
Sorry to disappoint you, I said.
What are you?
He hadn't asked who. He'd asked what. It was a very different question. It sort of stopped me for a second.
I'm Anita Blake. This is Larry Kirkland. We're animators.
I take it you don't draw cartoons, he said.
It made me smile. No, we raise the dead. Animate, from the Latin, to give life.
Is that all you do?
He was staring at me very intently, like there was something written on the inside of my skull and he was trying to read it. It was an uncomfortable level of scrutiny, but I've been stared at by the best. I met his eyes and answered,
I'm a licensed vampire executioner.
He shook his head gently.
I didn't ask what you did for a living. I asked what you were.
I frowned. Maybe I don't understand the question.
Perhaps you don't, but your friend asked what I was. You said I was a fairy. I ask you what you are, and you describe your job. It would be like me saying I'm a bartender.
I don't know how to answer you then, I said.
He was still staring at me.
Yes, you do.
I can see a word in your eyes. One word.
When he said it, a word did come to mind. Necromancer.
I'm a necromancer.
Magnus nodded.
Does Mr. Sterling know what you are?
I doubt he'd understand, even if I told him.
Do you really have the ability to control all types of undead?
Magnus asked.
Can you really make 100 shoes in a single night?
I asked.
Magnus smiled. Wrong kind of fairy.
Yeah, I said.
If you're working for Sterling, why are you here? I hope you didn't come here to try to persuade me to sell. I'd hate to have to say no to such a lovely woman.
Can the compliments, Magnus. It won't get you anywhere.
What would get me somewhere?
I sighed.
I've got too many men on my plate now.
That's the God's honest truth, Larry muttered.
I frowned at him. I'm not asking you out on a date. I'm asking you into my bed.
I frowned at Magnus. No, glared was a better word.
Not in this lifetime.
Sex between supernatural beings is always amazing, Anita.
I'm not a supernatural being.
Now who's splitting hairs? I didn't know what to say to that, so I said nothing. I rarely get in trouble with silence. Magnus smiled.
I've made you uncomfortable.
I am sorry, but I'd never have forgiven myself if I hadn't asked. It's been a long time since I was with anyone who wasn't straight human. Let me buy you both drinks, to make up for my rudeness.
I shook my head.
Menus would be fine. We haven't eaten yet.
The meals will be on the house.
No, I said.
Why not?
Because I don't particularly like you, and I don't take favors from people I don't like. He sat back in his chair, a strange, almost startled expression on his face.
You are direct.
You have no idea, Larry said.
I resisted the urge to kick Larry under the table and said,
Can we have some menus?
He raised a hand and called,
Two menus, Dory.
Dory brought them over.
I'm part owner of this place, not your waitress, Magnus. Hurry it up.
Don't forget that appointment I've got tonight, Dory. His voice was mild. She wasn't fooled.
You aren't leaving me alone with these people. I will not.
She glanced at us.
I don't approve of Lover's Night. You know that.
I'll take care of everybody before I leave.
You won't have to sully your morals.
She glared at all of us in turn.
You're leaving with them?
No, he said. She turned on her heel and stalked back to the bar. The men who weren't paired off watched her swaying back carefully, not staring until she couldn't see them.
Your sister doesn't approve of abusing glamour? I asked.
Dory doesn't approve of a lot of things.
She has morals.
Implying I don't, he said. I shrugged.
You said it, not me.
She always this judgmental? He asked Larry.
Larry nodded.
Usually.
Let's just order our food, I said. Larry smiled, but he looked down at the menu. It was a laminated piece of paper printed on both sides. I ordered a cheeseburger, well done, house fries, and a large Coke. I hadn't had caffeine in several hours. I was running low. Larry was frowning at the menu.
I don't think I could eat a hamburger right now.
They've got salads, I said. Magnus laid his fingertips against the back of Larry's hand.
Something swims up behind your eyes. Something awful, just behind your eyes.
Larry stared at him.
I don't know what you mean.
I grabbed Magnus's wrist and pulled him away from Larry. He turned his eyes to me, but there was more than just their color to make them hard to stare at. The pupil of his eyes had spiraled down like the eye of a bird. Human eyes just didn't do that. I was suddenly very aware that I was still holding his wrist. I drew my hand away.
Stop reading us, Magnus.
You wore gloves, or I'd be able to tell what you'd touched, he said.
It's an ongoing police investigation. Anything you discern by psychic means must be held confidential, or you're liable just as if you stole information out of our files.
Do you always do that?
He asked.
What?
Quote the law when you're nervous?
Sometimes, I said.
I saw blood, that's all.
My gifts are rather limited in the area of far-seeing. You should shake Dory's hand. Far-seeing is her strong suit.
Thanks, but no thanks, Larry said.
He smiled.
You are not police, or you wouldn't have threatened me with the police, but you were with them earlier.
Why?
I thought all you saw was blood, I said.
He had the grace to look embarrassed. Nice to know he could be embarrassed.
A little bit more, perhaps.
Touch clairvoyance isn't a traditional fey power.
Our many times great-grandmother was the daughter of a shaman, so the story goes.
Getting magic from both sides of the family tree, I said.
Dirty pool.
Clairvoyance isn't magic, Larry said.
A really good clairvoyant will make you think it is, I said. I stared at Magnus. The last clairvoyant who had touched me and seen blood had been horrified. He hadn't wanted to touch me again. He hadn't wanted me anywhere near him. Magnus didn't look horrified, and he'd offered to have sex with me. Different strokes for different folks.
I'll take your order through to the kitchen myself, if you'll just decide what you want, he said.
Larry stared at the menu.
A salad, I guess.
No dressing. He thought about it some more.
No tomatoes.
Magnus started to stand.
Why won't you sell to Sterling? I asked. Magnus cocked his head to one side, smiling.
The land has been in our family for centuries. It's our land.
I looked at him and couldn't read his face. It could have been the absolute truth, or a bold-faced lie.
So the only reason you don't want to be a millionaire is because of what? Family tradition?
The smile deepened. He leaned closer, long hair spilling forward. He whispered, and it was quiet enough that he needed to whisper.
Money is not everything, Anita. Though Sterling seems to think it is.
His face was very close, just barely far enough away for me not to complain. I could smell his aftershave, faint as if you'd have to get very near his skin to smell it, but it would be worth the effort.
What do you want, Magnus, if it's not money?
I stared at him from too close. His long hair trailed over my hand.
I told you what I wanted.
Even without the glamour, he was trying to sweet-talk me, distract me. What happened to the trees out by your road? I didn't distract that easily. He blinked long lashes. Something slid behind his eyes.
I happened. You cut down those trees? Larry asked.
Magnus turned to him, and I was glad not to be staring at him from inches away.
Sadly, yes.
Why? I asked. He straightened up, suddenly businesslike.
I got drunk and went on a little rampage.
He shrugged. Embarrassing, isn't it?
That's one word for it, I said.
I'll go get your food.
One naked salad coming up.
You remember what I'm getting? I asked.
Meat burned to death, I remember.
You sound like a vegetarian.
Oh, no, he said.
I eat all sorts of things.
He walked away through the crowd before I could decide if I'd been insulted or not.
Just as well.
For the life of me, I couldn't think of a good comeback line.
Chapter 10. Dorcas brought our food without a word. She seemed angry. Maybe not at us, but with us. Or with everything. I sympathized. Magnus went behind the bar, spreading his own special brand of magic to his customers once more. He glanced our way and smiled, but didn't come back to finish our talk.
Of course, we'd been finished. I was all out of questions.
I took a bite of my cheeseburger. It was almost crispy around the edges, not a smidgen of pink in the center.
Perfect.
What's wrong? Larry asked.
He was nibbling at a lettuce leaf.
I swallowed.
Why should something be wrong?
You're frowning, he said.
Magnus didn't come back to the table.
So? He answered all our questions.
Maybe we just don't know the right questions to ask.
You suspect him of something now?
Larry shook his head.
You've been hanging around with cops too long, Anita. You think everyone's up to something.
They usually are.
I took another bite of burger.
Larry squinched his eyes tight.
What's wrong with you? I asked.
There's juice coming out of your burger. How can you eat that after what we just saw?
I guess this means you don't want me to put ketchup on my fries. He looked at me with something near physical pain on his face.
How can you make jokes?
My beeper went off. Had they found the vampire? I hit the button, and Dolph's number flashed at me.
Now what?
It's Dolph. Eat hearty. I'll phone from the Jeep and be back. Larry stood up with me. He put a tip on the table and left his salad nearly untouched.
I'm done.
Well, I'm not. Have Magnus pack my meal to go. I left him staring forlornly down at my half-eaten burger.
You're not going to eat it in the car, are you? Just have it packed up.
I went for the Jeep and its fancy phone. Dolph answered on the third ring.
Anita?
Yeah, Dolph, it's me. What's up?
Vampire victim out near you.
Shit, another one.
What do you mean, another one?
That stopped me. Fremont didn't call you after I talked to her?
Yeah, she said good things about you.
That surprises me. She wasn't too friendly.
How not friendly?
She wouldn't let me hunt vampires with her.
Tell me,
Dolph said. I told him. Dolph was quiet for a very long time after I finished.
You still there, Dolph?
I'm here. I wish I wasn't.
What's going on, Dolph?
Why would Fremont call you and tell you what a good job I'm doing, but not ask for the squad's help on something this big?
I bet she hasn't called the feds either,
Dolph said.
What's going on, Dolph?
I think Detective Fremont is pulling a Lone Ranger on us.
The federal boys are going to want a piece of this. The first vampire serial killer in recorded history. Fremont can't keep it to herself.
I know,
Dolph said.
What are we going to do?
The body on the ground this time sounds like a straightforward vampire kill. It's classic. Bite marks, no other damage to the body. Could it be a different vamp?
Could be, I said.
You sound doubtful.
Two rogue vamps in this small a geographical area, this far from a city, doesn't seem likely.
The body wasn't cut up.
There is that, I said.
How sure are you that the first killer is a vamp? Is there anything else it could be?
I opened my mouth to say no, and closed it. Anybody who could cut down all those trees in one drunken brawl could certainly cut up people. Magnus had his glamour. I wasn't sure it was capable of doing what I'd seen in the clearing, but...
Anita?
I might have an alternative.
What?
Who? I said. I hated giving Magnus up to the cops. He'd kept his secret so long, but... What if the question I should ask was, had he killed 5 people? I'd felt the strength in his hands. I remembered the clean trunks of the trees, cut by just 1 blow, 2 at most. I flashed on the murder scene, the blood, the naked bone. I couldn't rule Magnus out, and I couldn't afford to be wrong. I gave him up to Dolph. Can you keep the part about him being fairy out of it for a while?
Why?
Because if he didn't do it, then his life is ruined.
A lot of people have fey blood in them, Anita.
Tell that to the college student last year whose fiancé beat her to death when he found out he was about to marry a fairy. He protested in court that he hadn't meant to kill her. The fey were supposed to be hard to kill, weren't they?
Not everyone is like that, Anita.
Not everyone, but enough.
I'll try, Anita, but I can't promise.
Fair enough, I said. Where's the new victim?
Monkey's Eyebrow, he said.
What?
That's the name of the town.
Jesus. Monkey's Eyebrow, Missouri. Let me guess. It's a small town.
Big enough to have a sheriff and a murder.
Sorry. Do you have directions? I fished my small spiral-bound notebook out of the pocket of the black jacket. He gave me directions.
Sheriff St. John is holding the body for you. He called us first. Since Fremont wants to go it alone, we'll let her.
You're not going to tell her?
No.
I don't suppose Monkey's Eyebrow has a crime scene unit, Dolph. If we don't have Fremont come in with her people, we're going to need somebody. Can you guys come down yet?
We're still working on our own murder. But since Sheriff St. John called us in for his murder, we'll be in the area as soon as we can get there. Not tonight, but tomorrow.
Fremont's supposed to send over crime scene photos from the first couple that was killed. I bet if I asked, she might send over photos from the second scene, too. Show and tell tomorrow when you get here.
Fremont may be suspicious about you asking for more pictures,
Dolph said. I'll tell her I want them for comparison. She may be trying to hog the case for herself, but she wants it solved. She just wants to solve it herself.
She's a glory hound,
Dolph said. Looks that way.
I don't know if I'll be able to keep Fremont out of the second case or not, but I'll try to give you some lead time so you can look around without her breathing down your neck.
Much appreciated.
She said you had your assistant with you at the crime scene. Had to be Larry Kirkland, right?
Right.
What are you doing bringing him to crime scenes?
He'll have a degree in preternatural biology this spring. He's an animator and a vampire slayer. I can't be everywhere, Dolph. If I think he can handle it, I thought it might be nice to have 2 monster experts.
It might. Fremont said Larry lost his lunch all over the crime scene.
He didn't throw up on the crime scene, just near it. There was a moment of silence.
Better than throwing up on the body.
I am never going to live that down, am I?
No,
Dolph said.
You aren't.
Great. Larry and I will get out there as soon as we can. It's about a 30-minute drive, maybe more.
I'll tell Sheriff St. John you're on your way.
He hung up. I hung up. Dolph was training me never to say goodbye over the phone. Chapter 11. Larry slumped in the seat as far as the seatbelt would let him. His hands were clenched tight in his lap. He stared out into the dark like he was seeing something besides the passing scenery. Images of butchered teenagers dancing in his head, I bet. They weren't dancing in mine, not yet. I might see them in my dreams, but not awake, not yet.
How bad will this one be?
He asked. His voice sounded quiet, strained.
I don't know.
It's a vampire victim. Could be neat, just a couple of puncture wounds. Could be carnage.
Carnage like the three boys?
Dolph said no, said it's classic, just bite marks.
So, it won't be messy?
His voice was squeezed down to a near whisper.
Won't know until we get there, I said. You couldn't just comfort me?
His voice sounded so small, so uncertain that I almost offered to turn the Jeep around. He didn't have to see another murder scene. It was my job, but it wasn't his job. Not yet. You don't ever have to see another murder scene, Larry. He turned his head and looked at me.
What do you mean?
You've had your quota of blood and guts for one day. I can turn around and drop you back at the hotel.
If I don't come tonight, what happens next time?
If you aren't cut out for this kind of work, you aren't cut out for it. No shame in that.
What about next time?
He asked. There won't be a next time.
You aren't getting rid of me that easy, he said.
I hoped the darkness hid the smile on my face. I kept it small.
Tell me about vampires, Anita. I thought a vampire couldn't drink enough blood in one night to kill somebody.
Pretty to think so, I said.
They told us in college that a vampire couldn't drain a human being with one bite. Are you saying that's not true?
They can't drink a human dry with one bite in one night, but they can drain a human with one bite. He frowned at me.
What's that supposed to mean?
They can pierce the flesh and drain the blood without drinking it.
How?
He asked. Just put the fangs in, start the blood flow, and let the blood fall down your body onto the ground.
But that's not taking blood for food. That's just murder, Larry said.
And your point is? I said.
Hey, isn't that our turnoff?
I caught a glimpse of the road sign.
Damn.
I slowed down, but couldn't see over the crest of the hill. I didn't dare U-turn until I was sure there were no cars coming the other way. It was another half mile before we came to a gravel road. There was a row of mailboxes beside the road. Trees grew so close to the road that even winter bare they covered the one-lane road in shadows. There was no place to turn around. Hell, if a second car had come, one of us would have had to back up. The road rose up and up, as if it were going to go straight into the sky. At the crest of the hill I could see nothing in front of the car. I had to simply trust that there was more road in front of us, rather than some endless precipice.
Jesus, this is steep, Larry said.
I eased the Jeep forward and the tires touched road. My shoulders loosened just a little. There was a house just up ahead. The porch light was on, like they were expecting company. The bare light bulb was not kind. The house was unpainted wood with a rusting tin roof. Its raised porch sagged under the weight of the front seat of a car that was sitting by the screen door. I turned around in the dirt in front of the house that passed for a front yard. It looked like we weren't the first car to do it. There were deep wheel ruts in the powder-dry dirt from years of cars turning in and out. By the time we got down to the end of the road, the darkness was pure as velvet. I hit the Jeep's high beams, but it was like driving in a tunnel. The world existed only in the light. Everything else was blackness.
I'd give a lot for a few streetlights right now, Larry said.
Me too. Help me spot our road. I don't want to drive past it twice. He leaned forward in his seat, straining against the shoulder belt.
There.
He pointed as he spoke. I slowed and turned carefully onto the road. The headlights filled the tunnel of trees. This road was just bare red earth. The dirt rose in a mist around the Jeep. For once I was glad of the drought. Mud would have been a real bitch on a dirt road. The road was wide enough that if you had nerves of steel, or were driving someone else's car, you could drive two cars abreast. A stream cut across the road, with a ditch at least 15 feet deep. The bridge was nothing but planks laid across some beams, no rails, no nothing. As the Jeep crept over the bridge, the planks rattled and moved. They weren't nailed in.
God.
Larry was staring at the drop, his face pressed against the tinted glass.
This bridge isn't much wider than the car.
Thanks for telling me, Larry. I'd have never noticed on my own.
Sorry.
Past the bridge, the road was still wide enough for two cars. I guess if two cars met at the bridge, they took turns. There was probably some traffic law to cover it. First car on the left gets to go first, maybe.
At the crest of the hill, lights showed in the distance. Police lights strobed the darkness like multicolored lightning. They were farther away than they looked. We had two more hills to go up and down before the lights reflected off the bare trees, making them look black and unreal. The road spilled into a wide clearing. A lawn spread up from the road, surrounding a large white house. It was a real house, with siding and shutters and a wraparound porch. It was two-storied and edged with neatly trimmed shrubs. The driveway was white gravel, which meant someone had shipped it in. Narcissus edged the driveway in two thick stripes. A uniformed policeman stopped us at the foot of the sloping drive. He was tall, big through the shoulders, and had dark hair. He shined a flashlight into the car.
"I'm sorry, miss, but you can't go up there right now."
I flashed my ID at him and said, "I'm Anita Blake. I'm with the Regional Preternatural Investigation Team. I was told Sheriff St. John is expecting me." He leaned into the open window and flashed his light at Larry.
"Who's this?"
"Larry Kirkland. He's with me." He stared at Larry for a few seconds. Larry smiled, doing his best to look harmless. He's almost as good at it as I am. I had a good view of the cop's gun as he leaned into the window. It was a Colt 45. Big gun, but he had the hands for it. I caught a whiff of his aftershave. Brute. He'd leaned too far into the window to look at Larry. If I'd had a gun hidden in my lap, I could have fed it to him. He was big, and I bet sheer size saw him through a lot, but it was careless. Guns don't care how big you are. He nodded and pulled out of the car.
"Go on up to the house. Sheriff's expecting you."
He didn't sound particularly happy about that. "You got a problem?" I asked. He gave a smile, but it was sour. He shook his head.
"It's our case. I don't think we need any help. That includes you."
"You got a name?" I asked.
"Coltrane. Deputy Zach Coltrane."
"Well, Deputy Coltrane, we'll see you up at the house."
"I guess you will, Miss Blake."
He thought I was a cop and deliberately didn't call me officer or detective. I let it go. If I really had a professional title, I'd have demanded it. But getting into an argument because he wouldn't call me detective when I wasn't one seemed counterproductive. I drove up and parked between the police cars. I clipped my ID to my lapel. We walked up the pale curve of sidewalk and no one stopped us. We stood outside the door in a silence that was almost eerie. I'd been to a lot of murder scenes. One thing they weren't was silent. There was no static crackle of police radios, no men milling around. Murder scenes were always thick with people. Plainclothes detectives, uniforms, crime scene techs, people taking photographs, video, the ambulance waiting to take the body away. We stood on the freshly swept porch in the cool spring night with the only sounds the calls of frogs. The high-pitched peeping sound played oddly with the swirling police lights.
"Are we waiting for something?" Larry asked.
"No," I said. I rang the glowing doorbell. The sound gave a rich bong deep within the house. A small dog barked furiously from somewhere in the house. The door opened. A woman stood framed in the light from the hall, placing most of her in shadow. The police lights strobed across her face, painting in neon Crayola flashes. She was about my height, with dark hair that was either naturally curly or had a really good perm. But she'd done more with it than I did, and it framed her face neatly. Mine always looked sort of unruly. She was wearing a button-down shirt with long sleeves untucked over jeans. She looked about 17, but I wasn't fooled. I looked young for my age, too. Heck, so did Larry. It can't just be being short, can it?
"You aren't the state police," she said.
She seemed very sure of that. "I'm with the Regional Preternatural Investigation Team," I said. "Anita Blake, this is my colleague, Larry Kirkland." Larry smiled and nodded. The woman moved back out of the door, and the light from the hallway fell full on her face. It added 5 years to her age, but they were a good 5 years. It took me a minute to realize she was wearing very understated makeup.
"Please come in, Miss Blake. My husband David is waiting with the body."
She shook her head.
"It's awful."
She peered out into the colored darkness before she closed the door.
"David told him to turn off those lights. We don't want everyone for miles to know what's happened."
"What's your name?" I asked. She blushed slightly.
I'm sorry. I'm not usually this scattered. I'm Beth St. John. My husband is the sheriff. I've been sitting with the parents.
She made a small motion towards a set of double doors to the left of the main entrance. The dog was still barking behind those doors like a small furry machine gun. A man's voice said,
Quiet, Raven.
The barking stopped.
We were standing in an entryway that had a ceiling that soared up to the roof, as if the architect had cut a piece out of the room above us to create the sweeping space. A crystal chandelier sparkled light down on us. The light cut a rectangle out of the darkened room to our right. There was a glimpse of a cherrywood dining room set so polished it gleamed. The hallway cut straight back to a distant door that probably led to the kitchen. Stairs ran along the wall with the double doors. The banister and door edges were white. The carpet was pale blue. The wallpaper white with tiny blue flowers and tinier leaves. It was open and airy, bright and welcoming, and utterly quiet. If we could have found a piece of uncarpeted floor, we would have dropped a pin and listened to it bounce. Beth St. John led us up the blue and white stairway. In the center of the hallway on the right-hand side was a series of family portraits. They began with a smiling couple. Smiling couple and smiling baby. Smiling couple and one smiling baby, one crying baby. I walked down the hallway, watching the years pass by. The babies became children, a girl and a boy. A miniature black poodle appeared in the pictures. The girl was the oldest, but only by about a year. The parents grew older, but didn't seem to mind. The parents and the girl smiled. Sometimes the boy did, sometimes he didn't. The boy smiled more on the other wall, where the camera had caught him tanned with a fish, or with hair slicked back from just coming out of the pool. The girl smiled everywhere you looked. I wondered which of them was dead. There was a window at the end of the hallway. The white drapes framed it. No one had bothered to draw them. The window looked like a black mirror. The darkness pressed against the glass like it had weight. Beth St. John knocked on the last door to the right, next to that pressing darkness.
David, the detectives are here.
I let that slide. The sin of omission is a many-splendored thing. I heard movement in the room, but she stepped back before the door could open. Beth St. John backed up into the middle of the hallway so there would be no chance of her seeing inside the room. Her eyes flicked from one picture to another, catching glimpses of smiling faces. She put a slender hand to her chest, as if she was having trouble breathing.
I'm going to go make coffee. Do you want some?
Her voice was strained around the edges.
Sure, I said.
Sounds good, Larry said. She gave a weak smile and marched down the hallway. She did not run, which got her a lot of brownie points in my book. I was betting it was Beth St. John's first murder scene. The door opened. David St. John was wearing a pale blue uniform that matched the one his deputy wore, but there the resemblance ended. He was about 5'10", thin without being skinny, like a marathon runner. His hair was a paler, browner version of Larry's red. You noticed his glasses before you noticed his eyes, but the eyes were worth noticing. A perfect pale green like a cat's. Except for the eyes, it was a very ordinary face, but it was one of those faces you wouldn't grow tired of. He offered me his hand. I took it. He barely touched my hand, as if afraid to squeeze. A lot of men did that, but at least he offered to shake hands. Most don't bother. I'm Sheriff St. John. You must be Anita Blake. Sergeant Storr told me you'd be coming. He glanced at Larry. Who's this?
Larry Kirkland.
St. John's eyes narrowed. He stepped fully into the hallway, closing the door behind him.
Sergeant Storr didn't mention anyone else. Can I see some ID?
I unclipped my badge ID. He looked at it and shook his head.
You're not a detective.
No, I'm not. I was mentally cursing Dolph. I'd known it wouldn't work.
How about him?
He jerked his chin at Larry.
All I have on me is a driver's license, Larry said.
Who are you? The sheriff asked.
I am Anita Blake. I am part of the Spook Squad. I just don't happen to have a badge. Larry is a trainee.
I fished my new vampire executioner's license out of my jacket pocket. It looked like a glorified driver's license, but it was the best I had. He peered at the license.
You're a vampire hunter? It's a little early for you to be called in. I don't know who did it yet.
I'm attached to Sergeant Storr's squad. I come in at the start of a case instead of the end. It tends to keep the body count down that way. He handed back the license. I didn't think Brewster's law had gone into effect.
Brewster was the senator whose daughter got eaten.
It hasn't. I've been working with the police for a long time.
How long?
Nearly 3 years. He smiled.
Longer than I've been sheriff.
He nodded, almost as if he'd answered a question for himself.
Sergeant Storr said if anybody could help me solve this, it was you. If the head of Rippet has that much confidence in you, I'm not going to refuse the help. We've never had a vampire kill out here, ever.
Vampires tend to stay near cities, I said. They can hide their victims better that way.
Well, no one tried to hide this one.
He pushed the door open and made a little arm gesture, ushering us in. The wallpaper was all pink roses, big old-fashioned cabbage roses. There was an honest-to-God vanity, with a raised mirror and everything, that looked like it might be an antique, but everything else was white wicker and pink lace. It looked like the room for a much younger girl. The girl lay on the narrow bed. The bedspread matched the wallpaper. The sheets twisted up underneath her body were jelly bean pink. Her head lay on the edge of the pillows, as if it had slipped to one side after she was laid on them. The pink curtains fanned against the open window. A cool breeze crawled through the room, ruffling her thick black hair. It had been curled and styled with hair gel. There was a small red stain under her face and neck where the sheets had soaked up some blood. I was betting there was a bite mark on that side of the neck. She wore makeup not nearly as well applied as Beth St. John's, but the attempt had been made. The lipstick was badly smeared. One arm hung off into space, the hand half-cupped as if reaching for something. The nails were shiny with fresh red nail polish. Her long legs were spread-eagled on the bed. There were two fang marks high on her inner thigh, not fresh, though. Her toenails were painted to match her fingers. She was still almost wearing the black teddy she'd started the night in. The straps had been pushed down her shoulders, exposing small, well-formed breasts. The crotch had been ripped out, or was one of the ones that snapped open, because the bottom was pushed up nearly to her waist until the teddy was little more than a belt. With her legs spread wide, she was completely exposed. That, more than anything, pissed me off. He could have at least covered her up, not left her like some whore. It was arrogant and cruel. Larry was standing across the room at the other window. It was open, too, spilling cool air into the room.
Have you touched anything?
St. John shook his head.
Have you taken any photos?
No. I took a deep breath, reminding myself that I was a guest here and had no official status. I could not afford to piss him off.
What have you done?
Called you and the state cops. I nodded.
How long ago did you find the body?
He checked his watch.
An hour ago. How did you get here so fast?
I wasn't 10 miles away, I said.
Lucky for me, he said.
I looked at the girl's body.
Yeah.
Larry was hugging the windowsill, gripping it with his hands.
Larry, why don't you run down to the Jeep and get some gloves out of my bag?
Gloves?
I've got a box of surgical gloves in with my animating stuff. Bring the box.
He swallowed hard and nodded. Every freckle stood out on his face like ink spots. He moved very quickly to the door and shut it behind him. I had two sets of gloves in my jacket pocket, but Larry needed air.
This his first murder?
Second, I said.
How old is the girl?
17, he said. Then it's murder, even if she consented.
Consented? What are you talking about?
There was the very first hint of anger in his voice.
What do you think happened here, Sheriff?
A vampire climbed in her window while she was getting ready for bed and killed her.
Where's all the blood?
There's more blood under her neck. You can't see the mark, but that's where he drained her.
That's not enough blood to kill her.
He drank the rest.
He sounded a little outraged.
I shook my head. No single vampire can consume the entire blood supply of an adult human in one sitting.
Then there was more than one, he said.
You mean the bites on her thighs?
Yeah, yeah.
He paced the pink shag carpet in quick, nervous strides.
Those marks are at least a couple of days old, I said.
So he hypnotized her twice before, but this time he killed her.
It's awfully early for a teenager to be going to bed.
Her mother said she wasn't feeling well.
That I believed. Even if you want it to happen, that much blood loss can take the sparkle out of your step.
She fixed her hair and makeup before she went to bed, I said.
So?
Did you know this girl?
Yes, hell yes. This is a small town, Miss Blake. We all know each other. She was a good kid, never in any trouble. You never found her parked with a boy or out drinking. She was a good girl.
I believe she was a good girl, Sheriff St. John. Being murdered doesn't make you a bad person.
He nodded, but his eyes were sort of wild, too much white showing. I wanted to ask how many murders he'd seen, but didn't. Whether this was his first or his 21st, he was sheriff.
What do you think happened here, Sheriff?
I'd asked the question once, but I was willing to try it again.
A vampire raped and killed Ellie Quinlan. That's what happened here.
He said it almost defiantly, like he didn't believe it either.
This wasn't rape, Sheriff. Ellie Quinlan invited her killer into this room.
He paced to the far window and stood like Larry had, staring out into the darkness. He wrapped his arms around himself like he was hugging himself.
How am I going to tell her parents, her kid brother, that she let some thing make love to her, that she'd been letting it feed off her? How can I tell them that?
Well, in 3 nights, 2 counting tonight, Ellie can rise from the dead and tell them herself. He turned back to me, his face pale with shock. He shook his head slowly.
They want her staked.
What?
They want her staked. They don't want her to rise as a vampire. I stared down at the still warm body. I shook my head.
She'll rise in 2 more nights.
The family doesn't want it.
If she was a vampire, it would be murder to stake her just because her family doesn't want her to be one.
But she's not a vampire yet, St. John said. She's a corpse.
The coroner will have to certify death before she can be staked. That can take a little time.
He shook his head. I know Doc Campbell. He'll speed it along for us. I stood there, staring down at the girl.
She didn't plan to die, Sheriff. This isn't a suicide. She's planning on coming back.
You can't know that. I stared at him. I do know that, and so do you. If we stake her before she can rise from the dead, it's murder.
Not according to the law.
I am not going to take out the head and heart of a 17-year-old girl just because her parents don't like the lifestyle she's chosen.
She's dead, Miss Blake.
It's Ms. Blake, and I know she's dead. I know what she'll become, probably better than you do.
Then you understand why they want it done.
I looked at him. I did understand.
There was a time when I could have done it and felt good about it. Felt like I was helping the family, freeing her soul. Now, I just wasn't sure anymore.
Let her parents think about it for 24 hours. Trust me on this. They're horrified right now and grief-stricken. Are they really in a position to decide what happens to her?
They're her parents.
Yeah, and 2 days from now, would they rather have her on her feet, talking to them, or dead in a box?
She'll be a monster, he said.
Maybe, probably. But I think we should hold off for just a little while until they've had some time. I think the immediate problem is the bloodsucker that did this.
I agree. We find him and kill him.
We can't kill him without a court order of execution, I said.
I know the local judge. I can get you a court order.
I bet you can.
What's the matter with you? Don't you want to kill him?
I looked at the girl. If he'd really wanted her to rise as a vampire, he'd have taken the body with him. He'd have hidden her until she rose to keep her safe from people like me, if he cared for her.
Yeah,
I'll kill him for you.
All right. What can we do?
Well, first, the killing took place just after dark, so his daytime resting place had to be very near here. Are there any old houses, caves, someplace where you could hide a coffin?
There's an old homestead about a mile from here, and I know there's a cave down along the stream. I used to go there when I was little. We all did.
Here's the deal, Sheriff. If we go out into the dark after him now, he'll probably kill some of us. But if we don't try it tonight, he'll move his coffin. We might not find him again.
We'll look for him tonight.
Now.
How long have you and your wife been married? I asked.
5 years. Why?